Today's episode of the Axon Creative Podcast is brought to you by RX Bar. RX Bar is a whole food protein bar with no BS. Get 25% off your first order at rxbar.com/AC and use the promo code AC. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I am your host. So even the best idea needs direction. It needs someone to help you get to the heart of the matter, to really figure out what is the gem in the midst of the pile of all of the fluff and the dirt around the gem itself. And that's the role that an editor plays. And the role of editor can take many forms. It can be a friend who helps you get to the heart of the idea. It can be a creative director in an organization, or it can be an actual editor. And on today's show, we have an actual editor. We have Nikki Papadopoulos. Nikki has edited probably, frankly, many of the books that are sitting on your shelf right now. She's edited many, many high-profile authors. And she also edited my most recent book called Herding Tigers. And we're going to talk about how to get to the gist of an idea. How do you know when an idea is right? And then how do you prune away all of the non-essentials so that your idea is pure and that it resonates deeply with the audience you're trying to reach and has its intended impact? Before we dive in, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by RX Bar. So I don't know about you, but I really struggle sometimes to find good, healthy snacks, especially when I'm on the go. I travel a lot. I'm on a lot of airplanes. And, you know, when you're running through an airport, I mean, you're going to eat whatever is available. And that's not always necessarily the best choice. Well, RX Bar is a protein bar made with 100% whole ingredients and no BS, no bad stuff like added sugar, artificial flavors, artificial colors, etc. RX Bar is made with just a few simple, clean ingredients where every ingredient serves a purpose. It's gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free. There's no added sugar, no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, preservatives, and it comes in 14 delicious flavor varieties and seasonal flavors too. So whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit flavors, there's an RX bar for you. It's perfect for breakfast on the go. I'll throw a couple in my bag before I leave for a trip so I know I always have something. You know, sometimes I'm giving a talk. The talk is right before lunch. I have to run to the airport. I don't have time to stop for lunch. An RX bar is perfect for that. It's great for breakfast on the go, a snack at the office, and any other time you need a quick boost. So here's the deal. Get 25% off your first order at rxbar.com/AC. All you have to do is use the promo code AC at checkout. That's rxbar.com/AC and use the promo code AC. And we thank RX Bar for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, it is a great privilege to have on the show today. I say that very sincerely, Nikki. Nikki Papadopoulos. Nikki is my editor at Portfolio on my latest book, Herding Tigers. And she is a profound thinker and a sifter of ideas and someone who I have tremendous respect for, you know, especially with her ability to get to the heart of the matter very quickly. Nikki, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Todd. I'm so excited to be on.
Awesome. So, you know, I obviously just gave a little bit of the reason why I wanted to have you on the show. I know there are a lot of people out there who have to, you know, they have to get to the heart of the matter quickly when they're trying to do a complex project or they're trying to communicate with someone. I mean, you've edited any number of books that probably are sitting on people's shelves right now that they have no idea you edited. That have had tremendous cultural impact. So I want to get into some of that. I want to talk about how you think about ideas and how you push people to get to their best idea. But before we do that, how did you get into editing books? I mean, is this like from birth you said, someday I will be editing? Or is it, you know, like what was the journey like for you to get to this place?
Thank you. And thank you for your comment about the books being on people's shelves. I mean, that's certainly the goal. Right, is that we produce work that that helps people and that influences people, and I think your community especially is a community that we value a lot at Portfolio and that we're actively trying to help and to reach.
Yeah.
But let me answer your other question. So I don't think I ever really knew what an editor was for the longest time, because I didn't grow up in a family of publishing people, and I wasn't surrounded by publishing people. So I grew up mostly in Greece before the internet. So information was scarce and rare, and books, especially books in English, were hard to find. So I hoarded them, and I read as many of them as I could. My high school books got art and feminism and cultural history and a lot of really dorky fantasy and sci-fi novels, which we can talk about someday. And I was always really obsessed with books. I wrote books. I played a game where, you know, you would invent a book title and then try and think of what the book would be. That's awesome. I just had this constant, obsession with like books all the time. But I didn't know that that was a job you could have. So my, you know, my sort of professional trajectory was not a direct path. I thought I was going to do many different things. At one point, I was trying to convince my parents to let me be an intern at a puppet theater. At one point, I thought I was going to join the Marines. I was like, I'm so interested in everything in the world.
Wait, hold
I want
on.
To learn about everything
Wait.
In the world.
Okay, uh-huh. Intern at a puppet theater and the Marines, uh-huh. right? This is a big swing.
At the time, it made a lot of sense.
Okay, all right.
But I didn't really understand that you could create a career out of writing and publishing and talking about books if you yeah. weren't the author of them. Mm-hmm. So I feel really lucky that a series of accidents in the right direction got me into publishing. I started as an intern at Basic Books in 2006, and I was unpaid. 3 days a week, I would go into the office and I would reorganize all of the contract files. And Basic Books has been around for a really long time. So there's some really fascinating stuff in those files. And I just remember being completely absorbed by these like old faxes about foreign rights deals that were done mm-hmm. in the 80s and 90s and letters back and forth between the publisher and the editor. And it was just, it was intoxicating. And I think pretty much from the moment that I set foot at Basic, I decided that this was the place where I wanted to be. No matter how you know what kind of role I could have in the publishing operation.
Wow, so it's interesting. Like you love the publishing business. It never really occurred. I mean, not just your role, but like what you're describing. I mean, reading old faxes and being fascinated by foreign rights deals. I mean, even as an author, like that makes me very sleepy just hearing about that. But like the fact that you love that, I think you know. How amazing that you recognize that in the moment that I think I've found my home, you know, occupationally I found my home, but also that you were open to paying attention to that, because I think a lot of people have those little signs in their life and they never really pay attention. And so they just kind of move on to the next thing. But, you know, was it really clear for you at that moment? Like, I think this is what I'm supposed to do.
I think so. I mean, like my parents are solo entrepreneurs. You know, we talked about business constantly growing up. You know, I like to joke that for my dad, like Benjamin Graham is God and Warren Buffett is his one true prophet. I mean, like that was the subject of conversation constantly. And so I knew that I was going to be in business somehow. And I always felt that there was a tension that I had to pick between the things that I loved, which were books and art and ideas, and business, which is what my family has always done and is really good at. And when I got a glimpse that, like, I can do both, that was a really big moment for me. I do have to say, though, my dad only recently stopped asking me when I was going to go to business school and stop doing this hobby.
That's so funny. I mean, especially given how remarkably successful you've been as an editor, you know, like, and you would think, I mean, like you said, I mean, with your father being so into business thought and some of the transformational business books that you've edited, it's just kind of funny that would be a question. But, you know, I think people can probably relate to that. I'm sure there are many artists out there who are probably getting the same questions from their parents, even, you know, as they're listening. So I want to talk about the process of editing a book. And really, I think that this process applies to any kind of editing that we do in our life. You know, if we're doing a project, we're trying to create something for a client, I think a lot of the same principles apply. But specifically in your process, when you initially hear an idea for a book, how do you know that it's one that you want to work on, one that you want to acquire and then help edit?
I mean, there is a set of questions that you learn to run through when you encounter a new project after a few years of doing this kind of work. And I imagine it's not totally unlike what happens in like Hollywood or what happens with venture capitalists. You know, what is this? Who is it for? How do we talk about it? What does it remind me of? How do we signal in the package that people know that it's for them? And what value can we add to it that no one else can add in order for it to reach a wide audience? So those are really publishing questions more than editorial questions. But I do think that they are really important. When it comes to the idea itself, one thing that I like to say is, you know, an idea is not a topic. It's not like managing your career is not an idea. An idea is a statement that someone can and will disagree with. And, you know, a great example of this, and he's really good at this kind of shorthand, but is the work of Simon Sinek. Start with why is a statement that not everybody agrees with.
Right.
Leaders eat last is a statement that not everybody agrees with. And it's an idea. And if you hear that idea and it resonates with you and it touches something that you kind of thought that you might already be onto, you know that that book is for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how we think about the idea piece. Now, that's not always, not every book is about arguing an idea, right? A lot of books offer a different kind of service to the reader. And so that's also a question that we ask, like, what is the service being offered to the reader in this book? Is it offering comprehensiveness, right? Like our mutual friend Josh Kaufman wrote a book called The Personal MBA. Well, the value proposition of The Personal MBA is you don't have to go to business school, you can read this book.
Right.
Another kind of book, the value proposition offered to the reader might be, you're going to read this book and you're going to feel something. You're going to feel motivated. You're going to feel confident. You're going to feel less afraid, or you're going to feel empowered. So it kind of depends on like, what is the book trying to achieve, and has the author got a strong enough plan for how they're going to achieve it?
Yeah. And that's always, I mean, again, even that's a subjective thing, right? I'm sure there probably have been books that you thought were going to be smash successes that ended up not, and books that are surprise hits that you had no clue were going to be that way. Are there any, is there any rhyme or reason about why some ideas take off and others don't, in your opinion?
A lot has to do with the cultural moment into which the book is published. And that is something that we can never be 100% sure about.
Mm.
You know, when we published Girl Boss, that was the right moment for that book. I think if that book had been published in the Reagan 80s, it would have not met with the same audience at the same moment with the same message that they needed to hear. And the reason that that book worked was because there was a cohort of young women who were coming into the world, into the professional world, and having the sense of dissatisfaction that while they were very ambitious, the traditional structures of the professional world were not really for them. And that book came along, Sophia came along and said, you can be a boss. Mm-hmm. Even though you're a young woman, you can be on the cover of your own business book. Yeah. That is a thing that is now available to you. And that was huge. Now, if someone comes along and does that today, it doesn't have the same impact. And it could be just as good of a book, and they could have just as good of a story. But you can't recreate that moment of the cultural zeitgeist.
It does seem like there's almost like the earthquake, and then there are the tremors that follow the earthquake, right? Like the aftershocks.
Right.
People always try to capitalize on, like, I, you know, I mean, There were, a couple of years ago, there were a handful of books that, or really just like one or two books that came out with profanity in the title. And then all of a sudden you see profanity everywhere in titles. And it's like, people think that that's the reason it was successful versus the idea, you know, or whatever. But it is right. it's kind of maddening, you know, because to your point or your earlier point, this idea that, you know, because people, I mean, as I'm sure they do with you, you're probably less accessible to people than I am from the standpoint of like, hey, I've got a book idea. Can I run it by you? Right. Like I get that all the time because people know I write books and I'm always happy to talk to people and help them. But often I hear something like, my book is about how to market your business better. I'm like, that's not a book. Like that's like
good advice.
It's good advice. Like market your business better. That's fine, but it's not a book. I mean, a book, to your point, your earlier point, I mean, a book has to have a point of view. There has to be something that you're willing to drive a stake in the ground and say, here I stand and I'm going to offend some people, maybe even with what I say. And if it doesn't offend some people, you probably don't really have a point of view with your book. And I mean, you mentioned Simon's books earlier, and I know I had that same experience with Die Empty. Like people, I got so many hate emails from people who just hated that title, and they were really, really mad at me. But the people who got it really, really loved it. You know, they really understood it and got it. And so you have to be willing to take a risk like that with your idea. And if it doesn't feel a bit abrasive, then you probably don't really have anything yet.
Absolutely. It's funny, Todd, because I remember internally with Die Empty that we had a lot of, as with every book, we had a lot of conversations about the book, but the psychographic profile of the reader for that book was never in question. Nobody ever asked, well, who is this for anyways, right? Because it was so clear that it was going to be for some people and not for other people.
Yeah. I still get that to this day. I still remember the emails back and forth too, where we were like discussing alternative potential titles for that book. None of which were really all that great, but I know that I could sense that there was some trepidation about what to call it. And I do remember, I think actually it was Adrian Zakheim. I do remember a like planted flag, Die Empty is the title of the book, right? I think that's actually what it came down to, which I really appreciate. But I do think that, you know, when you're thinking about ideas and, you know, especially titles and containers and things like that, you know, I would love to hear your perspective on how do you think about, when you think about, you know, an idea for a book, or you think about a set of ideas within a book, right? Because every book isn't just one thing. I mean, there's a set of ideas that kind of have to hold together. You know, how do you think about what belongs and what doesn't? I mean, how do you really get to the heart of, hey, these are all good ideas, but some of them don't belong together. I mean, how do you sort through that? Authors do not struggle with having enough ideas to put in a book. Typically it's like, I want to write 7 books in this book, right? So how do you decide what stays and what goes?
I like to work backwards from the imagined use case of the book. Mm. So I like to think about who the reader is and what their relationship is with this particular book. And I have a lot of assumptions about who this reader is. My first assumption always, and this is very important, is that our reader is a reader. They read lots of books. I find it very difficult to talk about making books for people who don't read. That is a very frustrating conversation. And I'm not, some people are good at that. I'm not good at that. I'm good at thinking about how do we make something for someone who cares a lot about getting information from a book, getting an edge from a book, feeling like they have a relationship, an intellectual relationship with the author of a book. That's a relationship I care about very much. And honestly, it's because that has been my relationship with books throughout my whole life. I feel like many of these authors are not necessarily friends, but definitely mentors and people who I felt like have guided me at a particular moment in my life. But that relationship has gone two ways, right? Like these authors didn't just show up and boss me around. I looked for their book because I had a particular problem or a point of curiosity that I was looking to solve. So I work backwards a lot from that relationship. That's all very theoretical. Concretely, what that means is a lot of times I like to talk to an author and I say, what is the reaction that you want to have from a reader who has found your book at just the right moment? What is the what is the Amazon book review look like that is your that is success for you? Like, I met the person at exactly the right moment.
Yeah.
You know, you and I just had an email exchange about Herding Tigers and about I don't know if you want to talk about it, but about an interaction that happened around that book. Yeah. And I thought to myself, that's exactly what we were trying to do. That person, yeah. that moment, that is what we're going for. So by getting really granular about that, I think that helps answer a lot of other structural questions about what goes in the book and what doesn't.
Yeah, I think that's really valuable because we forget, you know, we don't just make products to make products. We make things to have an impact, right? And you know, that's really what our voice is. It's an expression through a medium to achieve an impact. And so if you forget about that impact, if you don't work backward from that, it's really easy to make something and get to the end of the process and say, ta-da. And everybody's like, oh, are you still making things? I didn't realize you were still making things over there, you know, which happens often. And we see books that, you know, people launch them with great fanfare and people are like, wah, 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 because it doesn't really solve a problem. It doesn't really have an impact. It's kind of a Me Too book, not Me Too right. in the very... You know,
not
in a cultural movement kind of way, but Me Too. And I like, hey, listen to Me Too. I've got some things to say. Well, no, you have to step up and really claim your space if you want to have impact.
Definitely. Another thing I think is important, and I'm stealing all these ideas, by the way. Like, these are all ideas that other people have had.
Sure.
Like specifically Seth Godin,
by the way, you edit Seth's books, which
yes,
I don't know if you've even
Seth,
said that.
And Seth has been a huge, positive, force in my life. But I was going to talk about Kathy Sierra, who is not one of my authors, but Kathy Sierra has a talk where she talks about how, you know, a bad book makes the author seem smart, but a great book makes the reader feel smart.
Oh, I love that. Oh, I love that.
It's very important.
Great.
Yeah. And if you don't leave space for your reader to have their own ideas and their own reactions and make their own connections, if you write your book in such a way that this is everything I want to say because I want to say it and it's really important to me, mm-hmm. that's going to be really hard for someone else to connect with.
Yeah, which is, by the way, a lot of the people that I sit down with, that's why they're writing a book. I have things to say. I'm like, that's not a reason to write a book. You need to write a book because other people have things they need to hear, right? And
exactly.
You have to flip it on its head because one is a very narcissistic approach and the other one is a very empathetic approach, which is why... Yeah, I always tell people when you write a book, you have to think about one person, not an avatar, not a group, not a target market, but like think about the one person in your life that really needs this advice right now. And if you were sitting across the table from them, how would you offer it to them and write it as if you're sitting across the table from them? And if you do that, you'll reach a lot of other people too. But if you try to write it to a group, you're not going to hit anybody, right? Because it's not going to feel personal.
I promise this is the last plug.
I'm going to
have
plug as much as you want,
but there is a new book out by my friend and mentor, Seth Godin, called This Is Marketing, that talks about a lot of these questions about how do you think about what you're making and who it's for and how it's going to reach them. And, it is a terrific book. And I would say that even if I didn't publish it, but I think especially for people who are grappling for creatives who are grappling with the kinds of questions you're asking here, I think it offers a tremendous amount of insight.
It does. I mean, just even the people like us do things like this framework has been really helpful to me and making things for someone, not just for anyone. Just the idea of you have to be willing to say it's not for you. That's a hard thing for people to do when they're creating work and when they feel the pressure of time and space and money. And their boss is screaming at them and, you know, it's like, but you know, that if your goal is to create impact in the world, you have to be willing to say it's not for you. I mean, Seth, we were talking before we started recording, but, Seth and I both spoke at a conference about a month and a half ago. And in about 2 minutes, as Seth does, he completely reframed the way I'm thinking about my latest book and how I'm taking it to market and some of the things I'm doing. And the biggest chunk of it was this idea of, I mean, back to the idea of people like us do things like this. What do the people I'm trying to reach, what do they do? How do they see themselves in the world? And what kind of story do they want to live out in their life? And I've not really been thinking about that. And it, as Seth does, in like 2 minutes, he completely reframed how I think about what I'm doing. And the book is just a wonderful articulation of many of those same sentiments. So I echo your praise for the book for sure. And for you, by the way, who endured editing that book through a pregnancy, which was probably not
through,
easy.
Through the final weeks of my pregnancy. I was 8 months pregnant when Seth Godin called up and said, "Great news, I want to do a book and I want you to edit it." And I said, "Oh, you know, like, I guess I won't be here when you deliver the manuscript." And he said, "When are you delivering?" And I said, in 4 weeks. And he said, "Hang on." And then I think a week later, a manuscript showed up, and we just worked on it together every day. And it was really wonderful.
That's just awesome. All right. So I want to just ask you one more question, because I know we have a lot of potential authors out there. And I know people, which, by the way, please do not email Nikki. Don't go looking for her email address and email her and, you know, send her something. There's a process for all of that. So please honor the process. But,
I can tell you what the process is.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. Is that helpful?
I think it would be very helpful. Yeah.
So I work almost exclusively with literary agents, and the reason why I do that is not because I'm a snob, but because I think it is better for the author to have an agent who works for them and who represents them. I work for Penguin Random House, which is an amazing company. We are the biggest publisher in North America, but it is a big company. So I recommend that you have an agent in your corner who is experienced, who knows the industry very well. How do you get an agent? Well, you can spam people, or you can think strategically about the fact that this is a people business. Mm-hmm. And you can do things like read the books that you think your book is like, and reach out to those authors and reach out to those agents and start to build actual connections based around shared areas of interest and care.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because the way I landed at Portfolio is because I had an agent, Melissa Sarver-White, who's amazing and awesome, and she was helping me. Yeah, she's incredible. But one of the ways we landed at Portfolio is because I was so obsessed with the kind of books Portfolio was publishing that I was just interviewing Portfolio authors left and right for the podcast. And, it was just so obvious and evident that this is kind of the stable that I belonged in if I ever wrote a book, because so many of the big idea books that you all were publishing were just right in my wheelhouse. And, it's kind of funny because I think you tend to gravitate toward the people who think like you, or you tend to find your tribe, I think, in publishing often. And I definitely found my tribe, with Portfolio, I think, again, because I was resonating so deeply with the stuff that you all were putting out at the time. So what advice do you have then for potential authors about how to shape their content and to get it into the world?
Well, the cliched advice is to write a lot, but it's cliched for a reason, right? Like, if you want to be an Olympic skier, you should probably put some skis on at some point.
But the
point at the heart of that advice is not just to write, but to share your work often, and to be listening for who it is touching and who it is not. Don't hoard it, because hoarding is a form of hiding. And when you tell yourself that you're keeping your idea from being stolen, what you really mean is that you're hiding your idea because you're afraid that people won't like it or that it won't be enough.
Yeah.
So ideas and writing get better when you're consistently and thoughtfully testing them in front of an audience. And thanks to the internet, there's nothing stopping you from doing that. You can do it in a newsletter, on a blog, you can do Twitter, or if you don't even like the internet, you can do it in physical form. There's these two amazing women in publishing who a couple of years ago started an analog newsletter about soup that they physically mailed to people who opted in through a Kickstarter, and it was really successful. I mean, if you care about something and you want to get better at talking about it so that people listen, then just talk about it.
Yeah.
And if you're doing it in a way that is sincere and resonant, then publishers and agents and all of those kinds of people, they will come to you, because our business depends on finding you.
Yeah, it's funny because each of my, as you say that, each of my books started with a blog post or a podcast episode, right? Where I put something out and all of a sudden it started spreading and I'm like, oh, I think there's actually something here that more than I thought was here. But if I had just held those things close to the chest, I never may have known that there was something there. I think that's excellent advice. I think people think that if I share it, somebody's going to steal it, right? And the reality is, listen, there are probably already 50 people out there writing about the exact same thing. Nobody's going to steal it from you. You know, but if you don't share it, you may never find the space that you are wired to occupy. You know, I like to tell people that, I think a lot of people would rather live with the illusion of invulnerability than test their limits and actually discover that they have some. And so it feels good to just
live. That's a great statement.
Yeah, I think it feels good to just live with this notion that, well, I could be a best-selling author if I ever put this out, but, you know, I don't really have the time to do it. I'm not going to go through the effort of, you know, it's easy to live with that instead of putting it out there and realizing, actually, I have limits. You know, actually, maybe it's not as good as I thought it was. That's a risk worth taking, though, because it's only when your work is in the world that you're actually going to have impact on the people you're trying to reach. So I think that's excellent advice. We have been talking with the brilliant, the eminent Nikki Papadopoulos, editor at large. That's not actually your title, but I just think that's an awesome way to describe you because you are certainly at large in culture. Nikki, if people do actually want to find you or learn more about you, is there any place they can go to do that?
I am on Twitter, reservedly, at Nikki_Pop.
P-O-P. Which, by the way, Nikki Pop is what I always call you when I'm informally referring to you, to like when I'm talking to my agent or I'm talking to Seth or anybody. It's like Nikki Pop because it's just so, you know, it's so great. It's a great.
That's little, what Seth calls me. Yeah.
Oh, really? It's, okay, that's funny.
Yeah, it's a thing. I mean, Papadopoulos is very long, but I'm on Twitter. I would say 95% of what I tweet about is books that I'm publishing and working on. And so if you want to connect with me, I am there. I also will be hopefully at World Domination Summit this summer.
The last one. I think that's where we met in person the first time.
It's where we first met in person.
It's
a wonderful community. I'm very sad that it's coming to an end, but but it was, and you know, we have a lot of authors who have gone through there and met each other through there, and so.
Yeah.
So I'm going for the last one.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Nikki, thanks for the work that you do, and thanks for taking the time to share your wisdom with us today.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you for bringing it every day with heart and sincerity. And I think you do a tremendous service to your listeners and to your readers. And I'm so damn proud of our book together.
Well, many, many thanks to Nikki Papadopoulos for sharing insights into how to get to the best idea. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or check us out at accidentalcreative.com/subscribe. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.